Hello, this is Pharmacist Tara Thompson bringing you a very special Movember edition of the Mix It Up Pharmacy Podcast. In this episode, we'll be sharing an interview that I conducted with two experts in the field of sexual health and medicine. One is my friend and colleague, Dr. Heather Quayle, to help me out on this incredible topic and introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Sean Hodges. So we know that across the globe, the Movember campaign seeks to change the face of men's health by encouraging education and conversation around men's health issues like prostate cancer, testicular cancer, and even suicide. Because many men do not notice significant changes in their health until issues arise in the bedroom sometimes, we're going to talk about men's sexual health and how changes in their libido or performance may be an indication of larger issues that need to be addressed. So for our special guest today,
we'd like to welcome Sean Hodges. He is a pharmacist. He is a compounding pharmacist, but he specializes in sexual medicine, both male and female. But today specifically, it being November, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, we specifically want to highlight men's health. So we're going to talk a lot today about men's sexual dysfunction, erectile dysfunction, all things sexual health for the dude. Welcome, Sean. We look forward to talking to you today. We know how much wealth of information that you have from a men's sexual health standpoint in terms of drug therapy and pharmacology, and we're just really excited about that. Without any further ado, I will give it over to Heather. She's going to announce Sean and introduce him, and then we will get started talking. So, Heather, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. It is such a pleasure for me to introduce not only a colleague, but a very good friend of mine. He is the owner and the CEO, president of Innovation Compounding, and I can honestly say through my journey, they have probably been my biggest cheerleader. So upon completion of his fellowship, Sean practiced pharmacy in a community setting and worked as a regional director for the nation's largest hospice pharmacy provider. Specifically, he supported health practitioners in the hospice market by delivering countless hospice medication management consultations and clinical presentations through various state conferences. Currently, he's the pharmacist and the owner of Innovation Compounding, a compound-only pharmacy just located outside of Atlanta that employs 39 pharmacy team members. Sean also consults with practitioners and their patients on men's health, women's health, and pain management. He serves as the president for the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding, APC, formerly IACP, and APC is a nonprofit advocacy regulatory focused organization that presents thousands of compounding pharmacists in the United States. The mission of APC is to protect, promote, and advance the art of science and pharmacy compounding, primarily by networking with state and federal legislators who had direct impact on patient access to compounded medicine. So again, not only is he an advocate for all of us healthcare providers, he's a huge advocate for pharmacy. So he is a wonderful role model, and I'm very excited to have you. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
So let's dive in. Let's talk about all things men's health and sexual dysfunction, and let's kind of try to normalize it a little bit for them to be able to just ask when it happens.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess if you look at men's health issues, I'm sure everybody's probably the number one thing that everybody talks about is erectile dysfunction. I think the little blue pill that came out in the 90s, and if anybody remembers Bob Dole talking about how he had ED, and Pfizer's talk about the little blue pill that's out there. That really kind of spurned, if you will, the men in the country to really talk to their doctor. They were starting to talk to their doctor about their healthcare needs rather than the doctor going back and telling the patient what they had their healthcare needs. So yeah, it's been interesting. I think that, if you look over the last, ED in particular, the last 20 years, it's, I think men are doing a better job of controlling their ED, which makes their quality of life better. And obviously their family and their spouses and partners as well.
So in terms of EDs, is the little blue Viagra all that's left, or where have we gotten to at this point in 2020?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. You know, going back before the little blue pill, most often patients, the way for them to achieve a normal erection is actually through an injection. And I know for all of our listeners, that sounds horrible, but
yes, as y'all cringe your legs closed.
Yeah.
Heck no.
Yeah. But if men were looking to achieve that erection, that's what they had to do. It's a small little needle. It's probably about the size of a half an inch. If anybody also has diabetes, it's basically a diabetic syringe. And they quite brutally, they actually would inject it in the side of the shaft. We still make that today. A lot of times when patients are on, you know, the blue pill or the other pills, Cialis and whatnot, you know, they work about 80 to 84% of the time, but you still have certain men out there that it doesn't work. And so they look to their doctor to identify other products that they can be used. And even though injections aren't used as like they were back in the 80s by comparison, they still are relevant today and they still provide benefit to our patients.
What's the pain level with the injections? I mean, is it pretty painful that you hear, or are men okay with it?
You know, it's funny. I think after the initial injection, they kind of understand what it is. And there is a little bit of technique involved. If you inject in the middle part of the shaft, there's not as much nerves there by comparison to the tip of the shaft. So if the patients know where to inject, we just tell them you'll be up and running in a pinch.
Pun intended.
A little bit of pun intended, yeah.
So one of the questions I have is, okay, a man goes in, he sees his provider, mentions it. What are the first steps? Do they draw blood? Should they be asking for blood? We hear a lot around testosterone and hormones and things. I know we talk about it a lot in the women's health world. What does it look like for men?
So men, you know, I will say by comparison of women, it's probably not as complicated. We don't have the complicated hormone cascade like women do, you know.
Yes, because
you still have to, you know,
very well.
Exactly. Men still produce estrogens and even a little bit of progesterone, ironically. But you're right. For men, our primary secondary sex characteristic is testosterone, right? So when they're visiting with their doctor, ED, you know, ED in of itself could be the primary condition, but in reality, it's probably a secondary condition. So, you know, for example, if a male was in a car accident, there could be some sort of congenital defect, for example, a mood, depression. So if you look at ED of itself, you know, you can treat that, but it's probably a subset of a larger condition. And most notably, the number one larger condition is low testosterone. If you look at it, the clinical diagnosis is what they call it as hypogonadism, but everybody commonly refers it to as low T, right? You see low T, that's really what that is. It's just patients that present with low T. It's something that starts as early as men in their early 30s. And really by the time they're 65, about 60% of men actually have low testosterone, clinically diagnosed as low testosterone. But only 5% of them are usually treated. So men recognize they have low testosterone, but a lot of times they still aren't actually being used and actually using testosterone to help treat it.
So what are some of the symptoms someone may have if they have this low T? How would they feel and how would they know that maybe they should be asking?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, for every male patient, it's different. But if you look at some of the assessment type questions, usually they're going to ask, you know, what is your energy like? Have you actually decreased in height? Have you seen a decrease in muscle mass? They'll ask point blank, what is your sex drive? Do you have what they call libido? Do you actually still have a sex drive? You know, those types of questions are going to ask. And then just overall brain fog, potential memory loss, those actually all could be indications of low testosterone.
So it kind of goes hand in hand with the female. I mean, a lot of the same questions we ask. And I always tell my females, let's talk about your male partner potentially. Like, could female sexual dysfunction can sometimes be a cause of male sexual dysfunction for sure.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Kind of goes. I think that's why, like, a lot of couples go as couples to sex counseling and sex therapy. And then a lot of providers now are almost seeing both patients. The woman comes in for an issue. The provider says, we also need to see your husband. Turns out they both need, you know, some sort of intervention, or vice versa. So I have a question for Sean. So as a pharmacist, I know that you probably get patients walking in terms of male and female, but if a male walks into the pharmacy and he says, you know, I'm having some issues, I really don't want to go to the doctor yet, like I want to kind of see what I can do, maybe non-pharmacologically or with supplements. Would you recommend a certain supplement to them? Is there anything they can take? I know it's hard to say without a diagnosis. You don't want to, you know, get them on something that needs more further intervention, but if they just initially walked in and you're, as a pharmacist, recommending something to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. Great point, Tara. I would say that for patients, for a male patient, diet and exercise, I know that sounds so cliche, but it really does work. The goal is to make sure patients can achieve a great quality of life, even without using medication, if you can avoid medication when possible. And I would say that's probably the number one tool that anyone would want to use first. So working with the patient, especially as pharmacists, working with them to develop an exercise regimen that's within their comfort zone, right? You know, you have to take into consideration their lifestyle and their workload and their family life. But if we can get them to work out and then obviously engage in a normal diet, you know, lay off some of the sugary foods, you know, and whatnot, bring in a little bit more of the good proteins, if you will. We do counsel our patients on that. That's really the first starting point. And so it becomes more of an education on the mindset on from a patient's perspective on what they can do. But then also there are supplements that are available. I think a good old oldie but goodie are just your B vitamins. They're your energy ones. So they help supplement your patients while they're working out. And there's a couple of other special supplements that are available. We have one that's called a men's support capsule that takes care of their ED needs or testosterone, and sometimes even patients that have prostate issues as well.
So what about patients that have like chronic conditions, your diabetes, your hypertension? What about patients that are on lots of different meds? I always like to ask my pharmacist this because I kind of want to know where it interplays with this erectile dysfunction and libido and testosterone and all of that, because it does for women for sure.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, you do have to look at those secondary comorbidities, right? What is the actual condition? So let's say a patient has diabetes. That's quite common to have ED with diabetes. And that's usually an indication of a circulatory issue, right? The blood flow, right? And the best way to achieve erectile dysfunction for a diabetic patient is really just controlling their blood glucose levels, working with the patient to make sure that they're on an appropriate diet that's conducive to their condition, their diabetes, depending if it's type 1 or type 2. And then also just working with the patient to make sure that their hemoglobin A1Cs, if you're a diabetic patient, I know you know what I'm talking about, is to get that under control. And it's ironic, if you can control your diabetes, your erectile dysfunction is much more manageable as well.
Which is huge, which is, right. what about hypertension? And what about just some of the other chronic ones? Are there certain meds that kind of stick out to you that patients should really question or ask their providers, like, do I really need that? Will it affect my sex drive?
That is a great question. Yeah, and the answer is yes. There are a lot of medications that do affect the performance of achieving an erection. Your blood pressure medications, number one, is across the board is something to look at. Finding that appropriate balance to making sure that the patient's on a balance to where, yes, it does control their high blood pressure, but also is not too much of a dose that affects their performance in the bedroom. Also, pain, you wouldn't believe it, but certain over-the-counter pain medications, ibuprofen has an impact on erectile dysfunction, actually negatively impacts it. So a lot of patients take ibuprofen daily, you know, they have arthritis or muscle pains. They just say, you know what, I'll just take an Advil, I'll feel better. And they will, but as a causality or a side effect of that, erectile dysfunction could be an issue.
Awesome. So occasionally we'll hear the patients where there's a desire discrepancy, but it's opposite. Usually it's my women coming in and telling me they have low desire, but I've had the couple few that'll say like, nope, my partner has that low desire. So is libido, is it true? Like, debunk that myth. Do men get low libido and what's causing that?
So the answer is yes. And ironically, it's actually very much the same as women in that regard, that women or men can get low libido. Stress is probably the number one thing. And I know that's probably a lot like for the women's side, but, you know, guys, especially right now in a COVID world, men, you know, they identify by performing not only in the bedroom, but giving to their families. And so a lot of them are just stressed right now with COVID and the ability to provide for their family. That is socioeconomic status can affect their libido, ironically. And so, yes, we do want them to take into consideration that libido is not just, it's not a fault. It's not their fault. We want the men to understand that libido is not just a female issue either. It can apply to men as well.
Which is so huge, because I think we always think it's the female that has that, and we never really think about that with the male. So let's go into COVID, since you brought it up, my favorite thing to talk about. So I actually wrote a blog all around COVID and sex just recently. And a lot of things I kind of talk about is what can they do to really kind of decrease their stress? I know you talked about diet. I know you talked about exercise. What do you think about just yoga, mindfulness? Like, do we ever recommend that for men, or are men totally like, I'm not going to do that? That's such a female thing.
Yeah, it's funny. And, you know, as a pharmacist, I do recommend that, right? Whatever they can do to control their stress, that's really whatever that identifier is. And you're right. We'll make suggestions about yoga. And I, you know, to be brutally honest, we'll even suggest, you know, go to the gym 3-4 times a week. Make sure you work out for at least 30 to 45 minutes to get your heart rate up for that long. Just not only from a weight management issue, but also a confidence factor too. And you're right. During COVID, I will say it's been a little bit more difficult, a little bit more challenged to have patients compliant with that. But we do still hinge on the fact that men, just the ability to get out there, exercise. And then also, obviously, is to talk to their partner as well.
Absolutely.
In a COVID world, it's changing because everybody's home office. You're around your partner much more often. So I will say it opens up the opportunity to have a discussion between the man and the woman, or partner, if you will, to have those discussions and open up about their issues with libido as well.
For sure. And go ahead, Tara.
No, I was going to say, I have a question going back to libido, in terms of what is available. You know, as a pharmacist too, we're always looking at what we can help the patient or the provider even. But for the patients and the people who are listening, I'm trying to understand from their point of view, like, what is available for me to increase my libido, not in terms of like non-pharmacological stress, yoga, and that kind of thing, which those are all really, really good points. But I know, like, in terms of FDA approved type medications, there's not a ton of things out there besides getting your hormones corrected, and hoping that that is a libido booster, so to say. But I've heard a little bit of buzz around oxytocin. Is there anything that you can tell us about oxytocin?
Yeah, so oxytocin, the way that it works, it works in the brain for both men and women. So yeah, it is a generally known as a mood enhancer. If anybody knows what oxytocin is, we call it the cuddle hormone, something that women produce in large amounts, especially when they have children. But yeah, men actually have oxytocin receptors in the brain as well. And we do. We actually have, we compound oxytocin nasal spray for patients. And so if, you know, you almost have to look at erectile dysfunction and libido sometimes as two separate issues, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of men could have the sex drive, but they may not achieve the erection. So if that's the case, then you're going to use a medication to treat the erection. In the case that you've just painted, the picture you've painted, it's men that actually have low libido is causing the erectile dysfunction. And ironically, I will say you could have low libido, but actually achieve erections too. That's, that is possible for men. But low libido, low libido in of itself, yeah, could be treated and managed with products like oxytocin, which is a hormone. Another medication that we talked about earlier is testosterone. That also is a hormone. And that can be given. You've probably seen, if anybody Googles testosterone, they'll probably, the first thing they'll see is probably the injections, right? And yes, that is the gold standard. But also, testosterone can be made into gels. We have them in lozenges, little trochees, if you will. And then we also make them in pellets. So the hormone, testosterone itself, can actually treat libido as well. If the patients work with their doctor and the doctor identifies that the patient doesn't qualify for hormone therapy like oxytocin or testosterone, there are other products that are available, like somorolin, if you will, which is actually helps stimulate the production of human growth hormone. So that's a little bit of a different treatment model. You do need to take somorolin either in the form of a nasal spray or an injection, but that also hinges and helps with exercise as well, which in turn would give you the confidence and thereby increasing libido or your sexual desire.
What are some other, sorry, Heather, go ahead.
How is somorolin and oxytocin? You said somorolin's nasal. How's oxytocin delivered?
So oxytocin also is given nasally as well. I would say that's probably our number one formulation that we develop at the pharmacy. Number two would be we can actually give an injection or even sublingual as well. But looking at the data and whatnot, I'm personally, I like the nasal spray. It's just one actuation each nostril, typically once a day. You can give it multiple times a day depending on how bad the libido is. But yeah, we do like oxytocin nasal spray.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Go ahead, Tara. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, what are some other, I know we talked a lot about erectile dysfunction, low testosterone, which kind of go hand in hand sometimes, sometimes not, but what are some other male sexual dysfunctions that some people who might listen to this may have or experience or want to know more about? I know that erectile dysfunction is always the biggest like question and comment and topic that we get asked, but I know there are other male sexual health issues out there. Can you touch a little bit on those, Sean, or are there any other ones out there we need to know about?
Yeah. How about specifically about drugs used for erectile dysfunction? Could talk about, absolutely. We have, so if for the consumer, if they aren't aware, the good news is Viagra, the manufacturer drug, did go generic. So that does drive down the price and patients can actually buy Viagra at a very discounted rate.
Yes, I think there's 38 of them. It's my soapbox, 38 or 40 men's drugs compared to women's too. Sorry.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yes. That I did not know. Thanks, Heather. Okay,
I had
cool.
to give that little jab right there because it's a soapbox of mine.
Well, we need to work on that women's side, don't we? Yeah. yeah, so for men, yeah, like Tara's mentioned, they have gone generic, which is great. But you still have men that, even though they are much more cost effective, which is great, they sometimes don't qualify for even the generic form of Viagra, sildenafil in this case, only because they need an alternative. It just doesn't work, or their diet gets in the way. So we do actually take the raw chemical sildenafil, that's the active ingredient in Viagra, and we do convert that into a lozenge. As well, that sometimes can help. And we do that for tadalafil as well, for Cialis. And then again, that's reserved for patients who tried the manufactured version and it hasn't worked for them. But then also we talked about at the top of the discussion was the injections, right? I know it sounds horrible, but you do have the available, and it's documented under the American Urological Association's journal, does recommend as a tier one therapy. And it shows that it's up to 92% effective, where for men that, regardless of sildenafil, tadalafil, anything like that, you can inject a product into the side of the penile shaft and you can actually start to achieve an erection within as little as 5 to 10 minutes after the injection.
Interesting. So I hear sometimes about just curvature or Peyronie's, as we call it. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of people don't know really what that is and if they're what the treatments are and even why it happens or anything around it.
Yeah, so curvature, that in of itself can range from just from a male's perspective, looking at it could be as just something that just looks a little bit different to actually causing a lot of discomfort and possibly pain. And so it's really when it starts to get to there where it becomes an issue. What happens is on the penile shaft, and I'm going to use my finger as a demonstration here. So essentially there's plaque that builds up on the side of the shaft that causes that curvature. It actually pulls on the fibrous tissue that's there and starts to cause that bending effect. Well, when that happens, what you really need to do is apply a medication, or you could inject a medication depending on about it is, and inject it into that plaque and sometimes that scar tissue to break down that tissue to start to stretch it back out. We do make a product for a lot of patients now. It's a topical cream that actually they would apply on the shaft. It's typically once a day for 6 weeks. And it does eventually straighten out the shaft to break down that collagen and that plaque buildup.
I'm going to share my screen for a second because I want our viewers to kind of see exactly what you're talking about. So as you can kind of see here, this is where he's talking about, instead of using a finger, the male penis, yeah. Kind of how it starts to bend. And there's that fibrous plaque. I'm just all about education. And the fibrous plaque that he's talking about there. Are you guys seeing my screen, hopefully?
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Okay. And that if you look at that red dot, that's exactly right, Heather. And that's really what starts to pull on that surrounding tissue. So it's literally just pulling on the fibrous tissue surrounding it. And so what we have to do is we have to eliminate that plaque. You can have it done, like we said, through medication. If it's really bad, it can be surgically done. So that would involve a consultation with your urologist.
Awesome.
And that brings up a really good point. So for people who are out there listening and maybe wondering like, ooh, that's me, or I think I need to further on this conversation, who would they go to? Do they go to their primary care physician? Do they go to their urologist? Do they go to their pharmacist? How would a patient know? I know they can always contact, you know, you, Sean, and you can guide them to a particular person, but if they're just Googling, for instance, who would they talk to about these types of things?
You know, if you asked me that question 20 years ago, I would say they would have to go see a specialist. But since the ED and that world and penile conditions is such commonplace, the primary care physicians and our nurse practitioners and that we work with, you know, they have all the knowledge now to actively treat those patients, especially for the conditions that we mentioned, without having to go without the requirement of seeing a specialist. So I would advocate, you know, talk to your primary care team first, your nurse practitioners, your PAs, your physicians. If they don't feel comfortable, if you're not satisfied, obviously you can talk with your pharmacist about that. We do a lot of referrals ourselves here at the pharmacy. If you already have a working relationship with the urologist, that would be a good one as well.
Yeah, urology is wonderful. A sex medicine expert. Exactly. There are people that deal in just male sexual dysfunction, female sexual dysfunction, combination of both. So let me jump back again, because I meant to ask this during my COVID question, because it's right there with us all free and clear, but there's so much mental health. And for women, I'm seeing a lot more women that are on medicine to help with anxieties, particularly SSRIs. And again, that's another soapbox for me. I really try to kind of get them off of that because it causes so much libido issues and things. Is that the same for men? Would you say, is there such a thing as SSRI induced sexual dysfunction for men like there is for females?
Yeah, we do see that from time to time. A lot of times patients are just over-medicated. And SSRIs as a class can cause erectile dysfunction for most men. So it's kind of like what we talked about with the blood pressure medications. You just have to get on that appropriate dose that can target, if you are having mood-related disorders, to target that and then yet not be too strong to affect your performance in achieving an erection.
As pharmacy people, are there any SSRIs that really stand out for you that really cause a lot of that? I know where it is for females. I'm just curious if it's the same for males.
I haven't, and Tara, you're a pharmacist as well. I don't know if you've come across it, but it seems from my perspective, the older generation drugs seem to be the ones that are the causalities on that. And in fact, we actually have to use some of the SSRIs to treat what they call premature ejaculation, where a patient actually cheats it. So it actually controls the aggressiveness. And in fact, we use the old drug Prozac. The chemical in there is fluoxetine. That actually, we're kind of using the side effect of that drug to help prevent premature ejaculation. But at high doses, it can cause ED in of itself.
I'm going to share my screen real quick because this is my favorite article on drug-induced sexual dysfunction. It has a great chart in it that, I mean, I use all the time when I'm talking to patients or just really talking about the different drugs that do or can contribute to ejaculatory disorders, erectile dysfunction, arousal, desire, disorder. So let me share my screen real quick, you guys, because I think this will be really helpful. And we can link, this is a public article, so we can certainly link this to the blog. But can y'all see my screen there?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So these are some of the drugs that are associated with sexual dysfunction. So you can see the antidepressant class here. And you see a lot of SSRIs in this particular list, paroxetine, fluoxetine, and those type. And then this first column is the ones that can contribute to decreased desire and then decreased arousal in this column. And then orgasm or ejaculatory difficulties here. So like Sean was talking about, I mean, even some over-the-counter things that we don't think about, naproxen. How many people are on naproxen or take that for pain and are wondering, you know, why am I not reaching orgasm or why am I not ejaculating? You never know what you could be taking that's causing that. So to answer your question, Heather about the certain antidepressants or SSRIs, this list is phenomenal and I'll link it on there.
Yeah, that's great. I'm gonna add a caveat though, because I don't want everyone to just go to their doctor and say, okay, I want off my SSRIs. I think you have to balance the pros with the cons. There are certain ones that are better, but sometimes the what happens if you don't take your SSRI is obviously a whole lot worse than the libido effects. So I think part of it is working with your partner. So that goes back into my really important question. What do you all think about sex counseling, sex therapist, psychiatry, and where does that kind of fall in? Women are usually very good about wanting to do that. We can't get their partners oftentimes on board.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, you know, it's probably something that even as pharmacists, we should employ more of that in terms of our recommendations to the patient, is because, you know, we sometimes do lump in desire and orgasm issues as one issue together. And I think as pharmacists, we need to do a much better job to separate the two. So if we do identify a patient that says, you know, they're kind of showing the signs and symptoms of desire issue, that along with diet and exercise, the sex counseling with your partner in a room to sit down and discuss, work with a professional that can help facilitate the discussion, I think could be a wonderful tool to help our patients.
No, I agree. And I am a sex counselor. So I actually started wearing that hat this past year because all of my patients were like, well, can you just do it? And I was like, well, I'm not trained to do this. but a lot of what I debunk in there and I talk to males about when they come in and see us is that it's not all about, for men, it's always about the orgasm.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say it, for females, maybe not so much, but I try to give them new ways of maybe looking at things. So if their SSRI is causing more of issues, what are other ways that you can look at intimacy and still feel that closeness and that bond? And we work through that with things such as just touch and things in that nature, and just kind of take it slowly so that everyone kind of is on board and gets to a place where there's comfort.
Comfort for both. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that. It reminds me of someone, a urologist out of California brought this to our attention. He said for men, you know, it's funny, if we have a bad day, if we can just go home, just have sex, achieve orgasm, it's not really a bad day. For women, it's so much different.
Yes.
You know, they have to be complimented, that, you know, things have to be in their place. They have to look good and feel good about themselves. And then sex is sort of the secondary, if you will, then they're willing to. And it's funny because it's really those two dichotomies that come together where you find it mutually beneficial for both partners. And that's finding that sweet spot for both the men, in this case, the men and women. But yeah.
And I think that's where therapy really helps, because you may hear that from your physician or your advanced practice provider or your pharmacist. But the problem is that we don't have the time maybe to get into that counseling piece
right.
of it. And I think that's where having that one-on-one time with a counselor or a therapist who's experienced in that really can kind of help guide people through that process and what it looks like for them and make it very unique and individualized.
That's a good point. Exactly.
I always say sexual health is we cannot look at the two separately. You can't just take the brain piece of it and fix the brain or the body piece and fix the body. If you have to fix both, it's a very biopsychosocial process. You got to get the brain right. You got to get the body right, the mind, the heart, the soul. It all kind of goes in together. So what we can do as healthcare providers, what you can do as pharmacists, a lot of times you also need your pelvic floor PTs and your sex counselors in the mix too, because it is such a multifaceted problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's dive in just a little bit before we wrap up. You talked a little bit about premature ejaculation. I know that kind of freaks a lot of males out when that happens. And I just kind of want to talk about what it looks like. Are there meds for it and how to kind of help with that?
Yeah, it's something, you know, it's something that we starting to see more common. I think it's funny about premature ejaculation is that, you know, we've always been so focused on helping the patient achieve an erection. We never really think about the secondary issues associated with that erection, most notably that premature ejaculation. And you're right. And it's not something that we actually bring up as pharmacists at all. When we do a health outcome assessment of our patients, we, you know, oftentimes when they're on our medications, we do call them, talk to them and see how well the medications are. And sometimes we will ask about premature ejaculation or the patients will report back to us. But actually it's starting to be, when you ask the question, you're starting to see, okay, it actually is an issue. And we do start to see it more commonly. And there are treatment options for premature ejaculation. I think probably the most common method, and I would say the safest, is probably just doing actually a little bit of a lidocaine application. There's certain swabs and medications that are out there. We even make a little bit of a numbing cream, if you will. That numbing cream causes a little bit of what they call desensitization on the set, on the shaft. So that actually helps reduce the number of the nerves at the tip actually from firing, and decreases the sensation, which helps the patient control and not actually engage in ejaculation too soon. Also, and Tara had pulled it up on that slide, and we mentioned it earlier, is the use of fluoxetine, which used to be Prozac. Mm-hmm. Giving a little bit of that, you can do that on a daily dose. And we found a little bit of literature actually shows about an hour before sexual activity may actually show some benefit. But you can do a little bit of a low dose fluoxetine, not a lot, 5, maybe 10 milligrams at the most. And that in of itself can help control the ejaculation and lengthen the sexual experience.
Does the lidocaine numb their partner?
It can. And that is a common question. We do tell them that is possible. It's not to the point where it removes any sensation for the partner as well, because you only need a little bit of that just to control a little bit. So we do expect that there may be some tingling sensation issues for the partner as well. If that's the case and the partner reports that that is an issue, then we would actually recommend that they move on to the fluoxetine capsules.
Would it affect it if they used a condom? Like if they did, I mean, I know it's not ideal, but if they did the lidocaine and used the condom, would it decrease the effectiveness of it? I mean, because then you could use lube too. I mean, it's a whole,
yeah.
This is everything with spontaneity, but I'm just kind of thinking other options.
Well, let's talk about that though. In theory, you're right. You can actually do that. And it's funny because if you apply a little bit of lidocaine, and then you apply the condom over on top of that, you're right, you are actually creating a barrier, so it wouldn't affect your partner. You can use lube. If you do go down that route as a patient, we would recommend that they actually need to use a lidocaine cream. Lidocaine comes in different formulations. If you use an oil base or a petrolatum base, which has some benefits, that can actually erode the condom. So you have to take that in consideration. But yeah, Heather, you bring up a good point. I think that if the patient's do report their spouses have issues with it, then yeah, absolutely.
What if the male applied the lidocaine? I'm just thinking, like, I don't know, I have to like get, you know, my thoughts, I don't know, as a pharmacist, but what if the male patient applied the lidocaine prep and then they let it kind of go into effect in terms of topical anesthetic type numbing, and then they wiped off as much as they could? Would that also kind of prevent it from transferring to the female or their partner, but they would still be experiencing the effects of it?
Yeah, so it's funny, what you're talking about is we call it transference, transferring a drug from person A to person B. And so in theory, yes, you could absolutely do that. Unfortunately, if you work under that window, if you applied it and then perhaps wait an hour and wiped it, the drug itself may actually wear off, so you may not experience that benefit. So if you do decide to go down that path where you want to apply it and then wipe it, just let us know as pharmacist or your physician know, and then we will formulate longer acting drugs. There's different kinds of numbing agents that are out there, and we would be able to formulate that specifically to your needs.
How long does it last then, usually?
Yeah, most commonly, it usually starts within about 15 minutes, and usually it's about an hour at the most. Okay. And each male patient's different. It's all about clearing the drug with your blood, but we give the patients a 15 to 60 minute window.
Okay, and then what about premature ejaculation? How quick, like a lot of people will ask us, where does that fall? Is it ejaculate as soon as penis touches vagina? Is there a time frame? Like I get asked that actually by some patients, and I never really quite know how to answer that.
I actually looked up these guidelines the other day. So if you want me to help you out.
It's, you know, I wear my women's health hat most of the time, but I don't think you can fix women's problems without fixing their partner a lot of times too.
Right.
So
definition out there from AUA, which is the American Urologic Association. And PE is defined, has a specific definition for the amount of time, and it's actually ejaculating within 1 minute of vaginal penetration. The secondary qualifier is that it's causing the patient distress. So if that bothers a patient and he does not want that to happen, then you could technically diagnose it as PE. If he's okay with that, then, you know, to him that's fine. But it's actually ejaculation that always or nearly always occurs prior to or within 1 minute of penetration, either present from the first sexual experience or following a new bothersome change in ejaculatory latency. So I know that's a lot of medical jargon, but it's usually within 1 minute. Sorry to steal your question, Sean, but I was like, I just looked this up.
Well, and from our point of view, Heather, it's a great question. We tell the patient, if you're ejaculating too soon, then your expectations, let's see if we can work on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
My world of a sex counselor, I'll take it as let's define too soon. And that's what we talk about in the counseling.
Yes.
Because they may say a half an hour is too soon and their partner may be like, whoa, no way. I need to be done in 10 minutes. So I think a lot of that, again, really kind of hones in on why a couple's therapy really helps a whole lot. Because people don't want to talk about it, you know, and it gives them the opportunity to feel comfortable. And I think, again, you know, I'm going back to COVID. We do a lot of things via the telehealth world now. So I think patients are getting a little bit more comfortable.
Right.
Where they don't have to look you in the face sitting there. And so it's on a screen. And I think it acts a little bit like a barrier. And especially for men who don't want to talk about it, I think they're more comfortable with that.
You're exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think we are about at our time limit. I know we all have to get back to, you know, patient care. So I just wanted to, again, thank Sean so much for being here. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You always keep us laughing. And we really, really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk with us. This is great.
Yes, we're so thankful, Sean. I think it's so important, some of the stuff we talked about today.
Oh, well, thank you again, guys, for having me. I will say for any listeners, I know they'll probably have opportunities for comments and questions. We will track that, and we'll get back to your patients if they have any additional questions.